hamster with a blunt penknife would do it quicker.
Welcome back to A Hamster with a Blunt Pen Knife, the Doctor Who commentary podcast. I am having a truly delightful evening today, doing Mr. James Lark's very first episode commentary podcast. James, how are you?
I am very well and having a fantastic evening as well, because who wouldn't be watching Delta and the Bannermen?
Are you feeling the love from this story?
I really am. I think it's got so much heart.
And, well, I was about to say, and has Doctor Who not had heart? Of course he has. Of course he has. I don't think he's ever hit this sort of tone before, though.
No, this is a new tone. And is it fair to say it doesn't quite hit this tone again until 2005?
I think so, yeah.
This has got a pretty new Who sensibility in a lot of ways. Not just the Welsh thing.
An impressive guest cast. It's set in Wales. There is a stress on romance and emotion. Yes, I think this very much feels like Ross T. Davies's Doctor Who.
Yeah, I think it does. And a script that allows its characters a chance to do character stuff and not constantly be focused on what's happening, not, you know, responding to stuff happening.
Do you think the majority of Classic Who is sort of plot first, character second?
I think it probably is. I think where you find exceptions are right at the start of Doctor Who, maybe not its very first few stories, but by the time it's into its kind of second and third years, you've got some brilliant stories there, which are all about this and have a very mature approach to drama, which I think you can argue it never quite recaptures, maybe never wants to. I mean, I think there was a deliberate move away from things like The Massacre and
Shame.
It is a shame. I think it's the most grown up Doctor Who ever gets in a weird kind of way. And I, you know, there's part of me remains frustrated that except in the work of Big Finish, we've not been given pure historicals since the 1960s, which is something that Doctor Who absolutely could do now. New Who could absolutely do that and get away with it because people would watch it anyway. So that's a big digression to say that Doctor Who is all downhill from the second year onwards.
Do you know, I went onto another podcast recently and I had to name five things that I absolutely love about Doctor Who. And one of the five things I chose was season three, William Hartnell's third season.
Yeah, yeah. It's got so many good stories.
The variety, the drama, the different genres they try, the rolling call of production staff and companions, you know. It's quite unlike any other season of the show, I think.
But the strongest points in Doctor Who's history are where they have there's a producer usually with a really strong sense of what the show ought to be, usually supported with a really strong script editor. And I feel like Doctor Who, certainly kind of for the 5 years before this, has been flailing around a little uncertainly. The Five Doctors feels like maybe just a last hurrah for knowing what it wants to be and celebrating its Doctor Who-ness. And then it's taken in all kinds of different directions and there's a kind of almost a desperation to pull away and do something different while there's a group of people saying, no, but it's got to be like Doctor Who and Doctor Who is like this. Well, what do you mean it's like this? And no one can really say why, but they don't
like
it.
Weirdly enough, it's the moments where they don't conform to that, what they think Doctor Who should be. So like Kinder and Enlightenment and Snake Dance. And it's those moments where they strike gold in those five seasons.
They're the ones that have aged the best. Absolutely right. And at this point, it's just a breath of fresh air. And I think, I think it's fair to say that this, you know, Doctor has never done something like this before. It's never done something that is this much of an ensemble piece in which all of the cast have got interesting things going on and interesting, you know, in which there are this many layers of plots, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Well, but also in a story with lots of visual flair, with lots of musical flair,
It's got plenty going on. I mean,
huge confidence.
it's pacey. It's if we were to kind of describe what we've just seen in what 50 minutes of television,
It's moving,
it'll
isn't
take a
it?
while. There's an awful lot happened. A lot happened.
Well, then the last thing I want to ask you about before we go into three is you just said there's usually the producer backed up by a strong script editor. But I think in this era of Doctor Who, it's 80% the script editor that is driving the direction, the tone. I think JNT is very good at getting the show made, at bringing in the right actors, but all the important stuff, I think, is Andrew Cartmell.
I think that's right. And I think that when Doctor Who really turns a corner, at around this point, probably, it's John Nathan Turner realizing he can trust this guy
Yeah, you
and
can
he
just.
doesn't have to fight his script editor anymore. And you suddenly feel everything relaxed. I think that it then cultivates like I said before, a brilliant atmosphere. And it feels like where there are missteps, things like the masks in episode one, it's because someone's been drafted in and doesn't really get the show. But more and more, they're using people as effects guys and costume guys and design guys. I say guys, there are some ladies involved as well, using the term generically. But people who really care about the show, the Mike Tuckers of this world. And suddenly it starts, or Susan Moore and Stephen Mansfield, who clearly were. Just doing overtime and not only doing overtime, but using kind of materials, not illicitly, but using materials from Spitting Image
Yeah.
because they had access to that stuff and they were able to use the leftovers basically. So suddenly the show looks better than it has any right to on its budget because a load of people are just doing more work than they have to.
This is also the story as well, where JNT and Andrew Cartmell were dancing around each other a bit during Time in the Rani and Paradise Towers, and quite a few times JNT publicly embarrassed Andrew Cartmell on set in front of like the entire cast and crew, and it was on location at Barry Island where he did it one last time, and Andrew Cartmell went, I'm done, and he walked away and he left Wales, went back to London, and JNT had to ask him, no, please come back, I need you here. They sat down in a pub apparently for a whole afternoon and evening, hammered out their differences, and from that point on it was smooth sailing between the two of them. So I think
There's a lot of
JNT
stories
he
like that. I feel like JNT had just
Well,
been
the thing
burned
was,
so many times. He'd fallen out with so many people. He didn't trust Sophie Aldred at first, did he?
no, but Andrew Cartmell, he clearly really likes JNT, and he says, look, what he was coping with at the time, which was this incredible backlash, this fan backlash that was going on at the moment, and you hear some of the stories about the fans turning up on locations trying to spoil everything that's being recorded in all the fanzines. Like, it was really toxic.
Well, and yet he had no one to turn to. The people who should have been supporting him, looking after him, were out for his blood as well. He knew
The
that there was a
BBC
whole
itself,
branch of the
yeah.
BBC
So
who just hated him and his program. What a
he's,
horrible place to find yourself.
and at exactly the same time, he's sort of stuck on this show that he really wants no part of anymore because his career kind of taken a knock because of it. There's family members getting seriously ill as well. So Andrew Cartmell is, he just says that I don't know how he held it together and managed to produce the show as well as he did, given all the pressure that he was under. And I just think it's wonderful that at this point, two of them buried the hatchet and then just had like 2.5 seasons of just working in harmony together. It's there, you can see
And
it on the
it shows
screen.
on the screen, absolutely does.
Well, we're not going to watch the argument, but let's watch the Terror of the Bannermen. Do you want to count
Imagine
us
the
in?
argument. Yes, we're going to start watching in 5, 4, 3, 2. One. Play.
This is the episode I'm very sad I can't hear the music because I think it's got lovely music in this episode.
He does a great job. And bear in mind as well how much music he did for this season. Because of course Kef was working on Delta when he got the phone call to say the score for Paradise Towers hasn't worked.
Did you
I
hear the
don't know if
alternate? Did you hear
I
that,
have heard the
David?
alternate score and it's a good call. And
Do you
actually what
think? Do you think? Do you think McCulloch's is better than David Snell's?
I absolutely do. Yeah.
Oh.
I think David Snell's. I think it feels like it comes from a different era of Doctor Who, for a start. I think it would have felt pretty retrograde, even in something like Terminus. It's that kind of dreary quality, all atmosphere and no pace. And what
it's a lot darker, isn't it?
It's a lot darker, but it does. But it's also it's quite morose. It doesn't capture any of the flavor of the place. It's just he thinks he's scoring a David Lynch film or something. It doesn't match the story. And no, I know that people will argue that Kev McCulloch doesn't match the story either. I think he does a darn good job for the 10 days or whatever he had to write it in. And I think what he does bring it is a much more a cinematic sensibility, actually. And we sometimes take for granted actually how epic the McCoy stories in particular, and late Colin Baker too, feel, because they're given a canvas by the musical scores that is only just available. It's a late 80s sound as opposed to the early synthesized stuff in Who. It suddenly has there's a lot more samples in there, and it has more depth and breadth, but also composers who are, I feel like Kev McCulloch comes in and sort of pushes Dominic Glynn into better stuff. I don't know how much of Kev's stuff Dominic Glynn heard, but he then goes on to write Dragonfire, which is Dominic Glynn at that point.
I think delivering that's a gorgeous score.
Head and shoulders above anything he's done before then. And then Mark Ayres turns up, and I feel like, again, there's this sort of, Kev McCulloch's stuff for season 25, I think, is really good. I think it's really well-judged, really interesting. But then you've got the Greatest Show score comes along. And so that's
gorgeous. Ghostlight.
So by season 26, I would argue that Mark Ayres is the right composer for that season, that Kev McCulloch's stuff doesn't suit the style that the show has evolved into. But I just think his stuff has pushed it so far forward. I think the music gets better and better and better. I mean, and then Dominic Glynn gives us Survival, which is an incredible score. So I feel like you've got brilliant composers working with very little time, pushing the envelope every single time and urging each other on to do better and better stuff.
As I keep saying, I don't really have the education to talk about music. But I do think that McCulloch brings pace and movement, like, even when there isn't any, I always feel like he's kicking the story along.
Again, it's that the comic book sensibility and the pace these scripts are written at, which isn't always delivered in the dialogue, but his music absolutely gives it that rhythm that it needs. And
the interesting thing here is the story has pace as well. You've married the two, and this episode 3 goes by like a lick.
It does. Look at this, and this is apparently McCoy just never driven a motorcycle before and about to drive them off a cliff.
And he's got glasses on during the rehearsal.
You can see in the long shots he's got glasses on. What a wonderful thing, though, to go from a chase scene through Welsh countryside, and now we've got a scene of beekeeping. Oh, and the baby's grown again, and that is Laura Collins, who I was in a pantomime with at university.
No.
Yes.
Did you ask her about Theatre and the Bannermen?
Well, it was my first time at uni, and you don't go to university talking about, well, you didn't in my day anyway, because you didn't want to risk. I remember going to the Freshers' Fair and bumping into the Star Trek Society, and I said, is there a Doctor Who Society? And the guy said, no, it died with the programme.
Oh,
so
no.
you didn't talk about Doctor Who. But we'd been doing this pantomime. It was a Sherlock Holmes. She played Lady something or other, who turned out to be Moriarty, and I was her butler. And I may have just got to know her well enough to drop in a kind of a tentative Doctor Who reference. And she said, oh, I was in Doctor Who.
Oh, well done.
And at that point, I was like, right, I need to know everything.
What did you say? This is the Queen's Hive.
It's the, the thing when you're trying to play it very cool, and said, Doctor, I have seen a bit of Doctor Who. And she said, no, I was in an episode of Doctor Who. And I thought, well, which episode? And I'm not sure she could even remember the name, but she said, well, it had Bonnie Langford in it. So I'm straight away narrowing it down to just, six stories. And then she said, I played a green alien princess. And I was like, right, you're in Delta and the Bannerman. And you did this, this, and this, and this.
And
you admitted,
went, oh,
you
Jesus
admitted high
Christ.
Voltage screams. And yeah, she never spoke to me again after that.
Well, I can understand that, don't worry. So this is all very important, isn't it? We're learning about that green stuff that she's sucking to make her grow and get older. And obviously, Billy's going to take that. So he's going to become
I'm not sure
part
how that
Shimmerin.
Works.
No, but I do like that bit of piano riff he does just there as he nicks it.
It's a good piano riff. He's got a good line in scene closers, has Kef. I feel like that shot, the first time I watched it, I was like, "What? Well, oh, hang on. Is Billy a
baddie
after all?
Is he
stealing that
is he
to give
Bannerman?
To..." Because I'm not quite sure how eating baby food turns you into
That scene there didn't work. Where they're all just shouting about the
tracker
and the thing, the bike's going all over the place. It's a bit confusing. Like,
it's a bit confused, but not as confusing as eating baby food and turning into an alien.
You haven't been eating that, have you, James?
I haven't, no.
It could kill you. Oh, do you know what? In a minute, they use the honey, don't they, to attack the Bannermen.
They do, and I always find that's slightly sad because he's got all those pots of honey representing lots of hard work and
now I do this is great the way he turns the TARDIS into a trap, but how does the Doctor know?
He just knows.
He goes, stop, you know, the
I think this
has
is
been booby trapped.
Right, so this that bumpy scene, is he wearing spectacles here?
No,
but, so he cut.
No,
so, but this is the
is.
One. This is
now he
this.
Is.
He's got spectacles now, and this is the scene where they're right next to the seafront. And I think he did just go heading for a cliff and didn't know where the off switch was.
Look at Bonnie's face. She's like, no, stop. Will you stop?
She's ready
fight?
To look. She's ready to leap out.
I think this is. The
you see her?
The
that's not
theme.
Acting. Look, that's it. They're going off.
Oh, I've never noticed that. Please stop this bite. Oh dear, she looks a bit like what's her face from Georgia Mildred, didn't she, in the sidecar?
Yes.
You ever watched?
Yeah, she's got an unfortunate
New
hairstyle
for
bumping up and down in the sidecar because.
That's it. This is all our lovely characters are going to come together now.
This
to
is
help
so.
Save the day.
This is so Russell, though, isn't it? To have slightly comic characters trying to explain a plot they don't understand to each other.
Yeah, think something like, what's a disparate group of characters? Like Voyager the Damned or something like that. You know, a bunch of crazy characters coming together. May I borrow a length of your ribbon? I think this is the sort of thing where, you know, that type of fan thinks that Doctor Who isn't taking itself seriously, that they're trying to trick them into thinking they're inside the shed with the bit of ribbon and then the honey falls down and the bees come out.
Yeah,
it's so charming,
It's charming, and it's also not doing the same thing that every other Doctor Who story before it has done.
Why?
It starts to feel like in the early 80s that every final episode ends with a fire or an explosion, or you know, it's
not everyone ends with honey falling from shelves.
I think it's fair to say this is the only climactic honey moment in Doctor Who.
There's a gorgeous line in the Giggle novelization, which didn't make it to the screen, where Mel goes, oh, don't worry, I once stopped a genocidal war fleet with honey in Wales.
Oh, Laura's turning into somebody else.
Well, she didn't have long, did she?
She didn't have long. Long enough to complain about it.
Oh, this is great, though. The windows smashing.
Windows.
And then,
how many times have we seen these Bannerman helmets? They're the ones from Earthshock, aren't they?
Were they in Mysterious Planet? Is it
retooled
the same ones?
In Mysterious Planet, covered in paint, and now painted black again.
What about Frontiers? Is it the same ones as Frontiers?
Oh, is it the same ones as those? As
oh,
well?
No. Frontiers is the Blake 7 helmets, isn't it?
That's right.
Repurposed.
That's right.
I do like that Delta just grabs her gun there and takes two of them out.
That's a lovely shot. Look, that's a lovely. It's what? How long was that? 15-second shot where they all ran into shot and delivered some. That's the kind of pace I'm talking about. That's the pace that I think Cartmell had in mind with these overrunning episodes. Just it was meant to be bam, bam, bam.
I like to think that Goronwy has been here for obviously many years, making his honey with his bees. And every now and again, a time traveler or someone turns up and he's pulled into an adventure. This is why he takes it all in his stride.
And do you think that every time someone turns up, they wreck his honey store and he has to start again from scratch?
Oh, bloody hell, he goes, right, come on, bees, let's get going.
You think Goronwy ever gets to eat any of his honey?
The unfortunate thing is no, I doubt it. That when the bannermen are covered in honey, they unfortunately have to sort of anchor their heads in a certain way so the honey falls over
Yes.
them.
Yeah.
Never
This is
mind.
great music. So again, and he's paced it really well because we had the kind of upbeat 50s stuff in the previous episode. Now it's a race against time, and he's giving us that kind of diddle strings on the top with the ba ba ba, which is a very kind of metallic rhythm in a kind of synth brass. Yeah, absolutely.
See, now that's how good I know it is. I know all the cues. But the bit at the end, when I go into, I love that so much.
And he doesn't overuse it either.
I don't think we see
It's
enough goats in Doctor Who, you know.
we don't see enough goats in Doctor Who.
And it's Wales,
And there's
so
real
obviously there's
jeopardy
sheep
here.
as well.
We don't think they'll hesitate to shoot the goats to. Ah,
Well, I'm
that's a
glad we
clue.
stopped short of seeing that, though. But the important thing is we're left with no illusion that when they turn up at the holiday camp that they are going to kill everybody. So there is some jeopardy in the
There's
climax.
never, well, we opened with a scene of them killing everybody, so I don't think we've, even though they look slightly silly and they act slightly silly, I think Dawn Henderson sells the Bannermen as a credible threat.
But in comparison, Paradise Towers opened up with somebody being murdered, and people are murdered throughout, and I didn't feel any jeopardy in the climax of that at
No.
all.
No.
Don't get me wrong, I do like Paradise Towers a lot. I think there's a lot to it.
I love Paradise Towers, but I all I can see there is a story that should have that really deserved a better production.
Or a director and a writer that were on the same page.
Yeah, a lot of people are not on the same page in that one.
He's got an entire gang of people with him now. And they have to all sort of spread out in a
No
line so they're all in
sensitivity.
shot.
Oh look, this is a again, just he's creating beautiful pictures here. Look at all these scenes. They are like frames from a comic strip.
Oh, you silly man.
You've been atomized. He should have said ionized for the catchphrase.
Oh, this is where Lollipop's playing, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's all, and do you know what? There is something about them blowing up the radio. They're like killing the music.
Yeah.
They're the ones that kill the fun.
It's real. There's genuine bullets going there. There's a bit of windows being smashed. It's what it is we've seen so many scenes of Gromwe in this very beautiful, tranquil scene. They're a disruptive influence. They're vandals. The threat they are is a threat to our way of life. I think that's really well communicated.
And they don't like music.
And they don't like music.
What is wrong with these people? Did you see McCoy there pondering the
I
full
did.
force could take us all with it? He's got the crook of the umbrella under his chin. I can't
Well,
believe I
no,
didn't used to like
I
him.
spent most of Christmas Day doing that,
I
very
bet.
expression.
Did you do with
Christmas
your
pudding, you say? Let me
other
think
half the
now.
scene from Silver Nemesis? You know, it's like, ah, oh, why didn't you tell me? You
Of
know.
course I did. Of course I did. Once we got the vegetables out for Christmas dinner, dust
There
to
we go.
dust, ashes to ashes.
Oh,
Well,
my
this,
trouble
it's
is,
an
right, is
upsetting scene.
we're both Doctor Who fans, so we both want to play with the Broly.
Yeah. I think there might have been a few jars to rescue there. I'm not sure they quite all got smashed. I think there might be some jars of honey in those boxes. I'm hopeful that there might be just a few of Gromley's jars of honey left over for a
A
piece of
crumpet
toast
or
at the end of
two,
this
yeah.
adventure. What's that you're hiding, Billy?
I'm not sure I'll buy this scene at all. I had to, Delta. If I'm not a Shimmeran, but if I've got to come with you, I've got to become one.
Yeah, but why? It's never been tried on humans before. What do you mean? It's baby food. You were feeding your baby. My skin and
No.
hair, they're already changing. That's not normally a good thing, Billy.
And really, all that changes is his outfit by the end.
I guess we're not supposed to read too much scientific. This is the point again. this is what fans wanted everything to be kind of scientific and kind of Christopher H. Bidmead level of logical
or Eric Technobabble. Seward levels of violence.
And what they're getting here is honey and a guy eating baby food and turning into an alien. So it doesn't need to make logical sense if it makes dramatic and romantic sense, which I think fundamentally that's the point of this story.
I think what happens come 26 is they manage to marry what fans want, gothic horror and things like that, and still do all the character stuff and the sweet moments.
But I'm glad that they did this. I'm glad that we have this.
It's unique.
Look at the way I love the way Hugh Lloyd is reading that book and he hands the thing over without even moving his eyes from the book.
He's got
a sword. This is gorgeous.
They take the table and he still holds the book.
They're all finding the... And is that Pepsi again?
Yes, it is, yes. Oh, doesn't Burton put the... So he doesn't hear the scream. He puts cotton wool in his ears and then he almost murders the doctor with the sword. Mr. Burton, it's over. It's over. We won.
I like aliens fighting whilst hiding behind big plastic animals. I think that's a brilliant image.
Big bombastic rock score as the aliens approach.
You're right. Bonnie Langford's not in this episode very much, is she?
She doesn't do anything. No. I don't even think she gets a line in the climax. She goes, stop, as the doctor goes towards the TARDIS, thinking it's still booby-trapped, and that's it.
Those stings look pretty horrible as well.
I mean, this is so great. It's like an action sequence in a holiday camp.
It's perfect. It's what other program could do this? The Avengers, probably. There are a few, but it's very Doctor Who.
It wouldn't be like this, though, would it? It would be set in the 50s.
No, it would be set in the 50s.
With all these crazy characters. Well, they would have crazy characters.
Would have crazy characters. I'm not sure they would have had quite the same elements.
Oh, my word.
Look, McCoy running downstairs is never not brilliant.
Please describe to me how great the music is right now, because I can't hear it.
Oh, just rising. It's one of Kev McCulloch's. It's not the climax yet, but we're building towards the climax. So it's not. And then we've got he's bringing in the drums. Whenever we cut to them. Really works.
I'm so sorry. I hope you wasn't expecting a sophisticated conversation.
Well, it's not a particularly sophisticated moment in the score, but it doesn't need to be. I think he's a really good judge of how much to place and where to place it to really make it speak in the way that it needs to for each scene.
The cuts here as well. Her eyes, the scream, mouth, great. The army.
I think finally it sells that screaming idea in a way that the sound effect hasn't quite. And that's a nasty way to go.
It is, but clearly he's just walked out of shot. One explosion went off, but never mind.
There you go. And they're all involved, as you say. They're all involved in the plot, apart from the Doctor's actual companion.
Yeah, that's a shame. That is a shame. Never mind. She could have been the Scream.
She could have been...
It's all she does all season. Mr. Burton, it's
he's
over.
Great, Mr. Burton.
And he goes, lovely. and a big happy ending. Love conquers all.
It's great. And if you think about it, that sequence leading towards the climax was a lengthy sequence, whereas we're used in Doctor Who to climaxes being pretty swift.
Yeah.
In fact, it's often the most disappointing episode is the final one. They whole eras of Doctor
Not
Who
here,
didn't
though.
Really know. Not here at all. No.
Well, and I think and
pacing
what
it really well.
Other Doctor Who story will give you a 5-minute coda like this as well, where we say goodbye to all these characters. Yeah. Normally, we're just gone.
I love the Doctor cradling that guitar as well.
But James Love has never been known for its rationality. He looks like he's talking from experience there.
Yeah, the way he said, he does that line. It's one of the moments where he just somehow makes endless shadows appear in his eyes, like a man who's, you know, lived too long.
You know what he's thinking about, don't you? He's thinking about Margot van der Burr from the Aztecs.
Is that what he's thinking about?
Yeah, Kamaika. Yeah. That was his great love lost.
I think it's just Sylvester McCoy channeling that regeneration scene.
Oh, maybe.
Just getting sucked back into that. Now, this spaceship set is the same one that's used in Dragonfire, isn't it?
The Nosferatu, is it?
It's the Nosferatu.
They just put a couple of furry dice in it, and it becomes and Glitz's ship.
Nobody could tell that they were the same.
Oh, can I do it? Do you mind?
You can, yes.
Here's to the future. Love is the answer. Oh, I love it.
I think that, again, plaudits to Geoff McCulloch for having the brass neck to put lyrics into a Doctor Who soundtrack, something that had never been done before and isn't
once
done again.
Before.
Go on.
So fill up your glasses. And
okay,
join
no, you're absolutely right. Rookie omission there. What I guess what I meant was he's put lyrics into the incidental music, whereas I would say that the ballad is a piece of narration that becomes kind of diegetic at various points, but it's a song, and I love it for that reason. But this isn't a song, this is Underscore. And that I think having sung Underscore actually shows a kind of confidence that, again, the show doesn't have until, David Tennant's first episode.
Geoff McCulloch is not short of confidence.
But some people would say that confidence is misplaced, and I would shout them down every time and say that, he brought so much to the programme. He moved Doctor Who's music on so far. I think he's produced three decent scores for season 24. I think he does his best work in the next season. But
what does he do next year?
He does Remembrance of the Daleks and he does Silver Nemesis.
Oh, God, that bit in Remembrance of the Daleks where they go Dalek hunting and it's like...
Yes.
That was the coolest thing when I was a kid.
When I was a kid, it was the coolest thing. But then I wasn't a very cool kid, so...
I'm not a cool kid now, so I don't care. Oh, he had a great line there, Billy. He goes, "Remember to feather the clutch."
Yes.
He gets to be cool just before he goes. Although then he gets to say, "Let's make this baby fly."
Oh, look, no! One of the honeys survived.
Oh, what a sweet gesture.
You've given me your only surviving jar of honey.
James, you're more than a collector. You're a man of taste. Oh, this is great. What is it?
And here comes the Glee Club, the next adventure.
Oh my God, it's the Skegness Glee Club.
Oh, we get some more music in there. It's just got a joyous sensibility from start to finish, hasn't it?
I'm not talking about the weather, but it's got a sunniness about it.
It's got a sunniness about it.
It's like Doctor Who as a crisp glass of lemonade, Beautiful. And finishes off with the wink.
Which is so lovely.
And it's an almost imperceptible wink as well. It's great. Oh,
what a lovely
fabulous
character. How many lines does Garonwy have? It must be about
not
three.
Not many. No.
But he makes quite an impression, doesn't he?
And yet we've all been asking ourselves who he is ever since.
Every day I wake up and I say to myself...
Yeah, I bet you do.
What's wrong with
me? Well, he could be one of the timeless doctors now, couldn't he?
That's right.
It went Joe Martin and then Garonway and then William Hartnell. That's why he's winking. He's like, I'm going to be up to these hijinks in the future, am I? Okay. Oh, that was great.
What fun.
Now, I'm going to see if you've been paying attention to the format of this podcast now and ask you what it is we have to do before we out this episode.
Oh, goodness. Is it three reasons?
Yes, three reasons. Well, let's go back and forth. You, me, you, me, you, me.
I wish I'd paid attention in advance. And
I could give you 10.
That's the issue with this one. I've no... absolutely no shortage of great things about it. Okay, no, I'm going to go it because I've been singing his praises throughout, and I feel like he's sometimes unfairly maligned. Geoff McCulloch. I think that Geoff McCulloch's work on Time and the Rani is perfectly appropriate for that story and interesting work. I think it's a good soundtrack. I think his work on Paradise Towers doesn't always land in the right way, but there's a lot in that story that doesn't, and he's been given just over a week to sort that soundtrack for a story which probably wasn't making a lot of sense, you know, in the rough cut anyway.
So and you say he was just working through the night or something. He wasn't sleeping.
Absolutely. I think he just, you know, halfway through Delta and the Bannerman, he gets a call. Can you do this in, I think it was 10 days. But it's a perfectly serviceable score for one that was written in that time for a story that's already kind of struggling to cohere. I think Delta and the Bannerman is his first, as you say, comfortable score. It's the first time he's on such safe ground that I can't imagine any other Doctor Who composer having to, certainly from that time. But you could see Murray Gold doing it, I guess. But I think Geoff McCulloch was absolutely the right person to merge those 50s sounds with his own sound. His own voice is very much in there. And to match it to this story, which, as I keep saying, has a kind of modest ambition to it. And he's able to pitch it just right in terms of not taking it too seriously, but absolutely raising the stakes, building towards all the cliffhangers, building towards the climaxes. And it's got a wonderful sense of place and time. It's got an authenticity to it, which I love.
I don't think any other Doctor Who composer would have the nerve to produce a score like this. And I'm very pleased he does.
Yeah.
Well, then, for my first one, I want to choose another unsung member of the production team, and that is Malcolm Cole for his idiosyncratic scripts for this. And I do believe that he had a lot of direction from Andrew Cartmell, but one of the best things Cartmell did was bring in this slew of, I think for the most part, young, but just really creative, enthusiastic, smart writers into this. And it is like opening the door of a dusty old basement and letting in the fresh air. There's just absolutely so much creativity, so much imagination in this era. I feel like we've been sort of leaning on the same writers in the last 5 years, with the odd exception. And he just knows the right people to suit his approach to Doctor Who. And on the whole, I think it works a lot. And I think this is unique. There is not another script quite like this that juxtaposes all of these weird disparate elements and throws them into the 1950s in a holiday camp. And only really Doctor Who would have the nerve to do this. But I do think there's a lot of witty lines in here as well. The comedy lands a lot.
The dialogue is well written. Yeah, I agree.
The characterization is really strong. You do care about these people, and it does have momentum. I think maybe there might be a few structural issues if you pulled it apart, but the production papers over all of that, and it just moves at a lick, so you don't really notice. What's between solid and brilliant?
That's a very tricky question.
It's a memorable script.
Competent sounds like damning with faint praise. Yeah. It's more than competent, isn't
solid.
It?
Solid. That's the worst word you can use, isn't it? It's a solid script. No. It's a memorable script. So Malcolm Cole.
Yeah. And I also think, in the same way that you said that Kev McCulloch's score takes nerve, I think to write a script like that takes nerve. And I'm not surprised that JNT looked at it and said, this is the worst thing I've ever read. It's so left field. It's so not Doctor Who, what Doctor Who had, well, ever done before, really, but certainly not been doing recently.
And yet, you know, JNT wanted to direct this. Originally, JNT was down to direct this.
Well, it's a musical. I mean, that's the one slight regret is that in a different time, they might have gone, do you know what, this actually does need some more songs in it, and committed to having sung bits throughout. They could have had a song on the bus. They could have
imagine fandom then, though. I mean, I think this is as far as you can push them at the time.
Certainly at the time, I think they're clearly further.
It wouldn't have just been tellies being smashed, you know. The television centre would have been bombed or something like that. Well, what's your second then?
So I was thinking in the long lines, I was going to say Don Henderson, but then I thought, do I have Richard Davis as Burton, or do I have Stubby Kay, who I think is so watchable in this?
Or Hugh Lloyd
Or Hugh
as
Lloyd, who I
Grom.
think is makes an incredible impression on very limited screen time. I think he's a fully rounded character who we would have loved to spend more time with. Or even like little characters like Murray is a really nicely played part. I think I'm just going to say the guest cast because I can't think of many Doctor Who stories that have got quite this many well-written speaking roles, actually. And I think they're all really well cast. I know we've talked about how maybe the Chimerian Queen is a bit too cold, doesn't quite gel,
It's
but
fine,
she,
though.
no, she does it. She certainly does enough right that you do care about her. You are rooting for her by the end, and you're rooting for her and Billy. And again, you say he's not the greatest performance in the world, but he does what he needs to. He looks nice. He helps the doctor wire some speakers together, and yeah, and he eats some baby food.
I
So
kind of
yeah,
think
it's
they
a
only need to be a pretty couple, and they are. You know,
they
I can
do
see why they
the
want to be
job.
together. Yeah.
That's a pretty couple in the Shakespearean tradition. So yeah, I'm going to go for the cast.
Then my second one is going to be all of those scenes in this story, and I'm talking about the execution now rather than the script, that you just wouldn't see anywhere else in Doctor Who. So I'm talking about the singing on the bus in episode one, the dance scenes, the get to know you dance, and the longing looks across the dance floor, the doctor dancing awkwardly, comforting Ray in the laundry room, the fade into the morning. But you just don't see that. I don't think those sort of scenes are anywhere else in Doctor Who. I
Yeah.
could go on for ages, but they're all part of what makes this its own thing, and I love it for that.
My third thing is something that's very close to my heart, and that is the Seventh Doctor's umbrella, which debuts in this story, and I believe was Sylvester McCoy's idea. Now, there are those who will say that a massive question mark on your umbrella handle is pushing the bounds of
Might
subtlety
not be
and
wrong.
taste. I just remember thinking when I was younger, a lot younger, what a clever idea, because an umbrella handle is the shape of a question mark. So what a clever idea. And yeah, I think it probably would have been designed if they were to have the balls to design a question mark umbrella. Nowadays, they would design it not in that massive, ostentatious red. But I used to like the question mark collars. Again, I can sort of see as objectively now, I can see how it's too on the nose. And I certainly never had much love for the pullover. I sort of feel like,
I loved the pullover as a kid.
right,
I
I
don't think
didn't
I
love
had
the
any
pullover as a kid.
subtlety at all as a child.
I think when I was a child, I was made to wear a pullover at school. So just the fact that he was wearing a pullover was a bit of a turn off. I thought he'd be better off without it. And I suppose I grew up at a time when you wouldn't be seen dead in a tank top. That would have been the height. That would have been just sticking a sign on your chest saying, "Bully me."
This
So
is a
I.
tank top covered in punctuation marks.
Speaking as someone who now occasionally sports a tank top, I think I s still wouldn't
How things change.
I still wouldn't wear one covered in question marks. But I do have a Sylvester McCoy style umbrella,
I better
and
cancel that order then. Damn
that was coming along with the
it.
chair. I think the image is just right for this era. It's like Ace and the baseball bat. Again, it's of its time, but it's this comic strip sensibility that Cartman wants to bring to it. And I feel like the question mark umbrella nails it just right. And of course, McCoy running up and down stairs or being chased by explosions with an umbrella is the iconic image. In fact, he has an umbrella, but not the question mark one in Paradise Towers. And there's a scene where he just emerges into the background of the scene, silhouetted against that bright window, him and the umbrella, and it's instantly recognizable. It's the Seventh Doctor. I think it's a great image. I think it's a great prop, and I think he makes great use of it. And it's the best Christmas present I've ever had. So yeah, the umbrella.
And you look marvelous with it as well. Do you remember the cover to The Rapture, the Big Finish audio?
I
It's
do.
McCoy in silhouette with his question mark umbrella,
It's a lovely
with
cover.
the Ibethan sun behind him.
Yeah.
God, it's glorious. You just that silhouette is so distinctive.
Yeah, don't always judge an audio adventure by its cover.
N well, quite, yeah. Good grief. Well, my third thing then is going to be Sylvester McCoy's apple. No, it's not going to be that at all. No, we can't do all props, but it's going to be Sylvester McCoy himself. And that's just because I've done such a turn with the character and the actor over the years. In fact, even with his Big Finish stuff, as we're going through that on Finish Big, it's a revelation to me how sort of playful and complex he can be on audio.
Have you listened to Master yet?
That's
That's your
no,
you, that's coming
it's
up, isn't it?
flip-flop next, and then it's Master after that. It's brilliant. Such a great story. That trilogy. Anyway, that's for another time. But
But just because I have been following your other podcasts, one of your other podcasts, and listening to the McCoys as well. I absolutely agree. And like I said earlier, I think his vocal performance is sometimes overlooked because he's such an ostentatiously physical performer, and he doesn't always judge the vocal performance brilliantly, but a lot of the time he does.
He does. I mean, I did recently listen to The Dark Flame, and clearly that is the first time he's ever read that script when he's performing it. You know, I think you can hear the pages turning as well. Like it's that time. But McCoy in Delta and the Bannermen is just very striking. I think he gets to be physically very funny. I think he gets to be melancholic at the end. He gets a great confrontation with the villain. He gets to look after Ray. He gets to be sweet and silly with Mel, you know, and interact with all these great characters, his weird knowing relationship with Garonway. He just gets to have so much fun in this. And I go back to the statement I said at the start of the story that he is one of the most impressive performers in this season because so much around him. It reminds me of Patrick Troughton in The Underwater Menace. Troughton's sort of gooning around
Very similar,
until he comes up
until he
against
comes up
Joseph
against that
first
villain, yeah.
and he goes, oh, I can never top this. So I'm going to have to go in the other direction. I think McCoy realized very quickly that, hey, what is it he says? I suddenly realized I had this great gift of a role. And, you know, he's playing it very broad in Time and the Rani. He still gets some sweet moments in that, but
He
he is playing,
does.
it is quite pantomimic in Time and the
His
Rani.
performance evolves very quickly, and you're right, this is a sublime performance. It
I mean, this
really
is where it
is.
solidifies. I think in
Yeah.
Paradise Towers, he gets great, like the rule book scene in Paradise Towers and moments like that. But then there's other moments where he's wrestling with the cleaners, and you said, you know, he's sort of learning what to do and what not to do. But here he's just completely at home, really impressive. And I think from this point on, he just knows how to play the doctor,
I think
his doctor.
the Troughton analogy is absolutely spot on, and it's another of the sometimes painful elements of watching the season 24 Blu-ray is that it's full of this material of people slagging it off because, of course, the BBC to promote their shows in those days would send people onto daytime television to be told their show was
Oh, it's
crap,
awful,
and it's
isn't it?
awful. And the number of people saying, "Well, he's just playing it like a clown, not like the old Doctors." Well, look at what Troughton does in the Power of the Daleks, where he's got a recorder, McCoy's got spoons, he's flip-flopping between wildly eccentric and quiet pondering moments, exactly like McCoy. The two are very similar in the way that they become this kind of the what is it Cartman calls him, the trickster, the superficially the clown, the Buster Keaton slapstick character, but with these depths and with this ability to control people. I think Troughton does a very similar thing, and I think you're right that the trajectory is that they both very quickly go in the opposite direction to accommodate for performances that are going at, over the top. They make room for those performances and for their own doctors by going small.
What I love about Troughton and I love about McCoy is that they can be very playful and very disarming and very funny. And, you know, Troughton can go and massacre a load of ice warriors and McCoy can go and blow up a planet. You know, like,
Yes.
don't get too relaxed with them because they could do something terrible. Yeah, it's so weird. The journey I've gone with McCoy is so satisfying. And I'm very pleased to have found somebody else who just loves this era as well. Celebrating this era is a
I think I
joy.
it's because I went through quite a lot of my early fandom, kind of feeling like an era of the show that had been sneered at, that was being sneered at by fans and non-fans alike. It was treated as a joke. Sylvester McCoy was a punchline in an episode of Armando Iannucci's show. I sort of feel like it was it, or and you know he was used as the butt of jokes by Tom Baker on Have I Got News for You by David Tennant when he did Buzzcocks. It was really until quite recently perceived as a low point, and it's just a joy over recent years. And when you see kind of what's being what people are talking about and how a new generation of fans are discovering the classic series, an awful lot of people are concluding that actually it went out on an absolute high. And it's always nice to find that you were right all along.
I know. I felt as if when you heard my Ghostlight commentary, that was very cathartic for me.
It really was, yeah. And to hear, to hear it articulated so eloquently as well, it's
Oh,
not just
that's
nostalgia.
Paul. He's
It's
an eloquent bloke.
he is. And there's always a danger. There's stuff that I'm going to love from my childhood that hasn't stood the test of time, but I feel on fairly kind of safe ground when I talk about the McCoy era. I'm not oblivious to its flaws either, but I think they are few and far between.
Well, let's go out on that high, although we've been on a high throughout, and it's a great chance for me to ask you, and I haven't been able to ask you this before, James, where are we heading next? That's if I haven't scared you off from doing another one of
Oh,
these. You've forgotten the
I
list,
gave
haven't
you a
you?
list. I haven't forgotten the list.
Okay.
Dare we take on Invasion of Earth 2150 AD, as in
Oh,
the
please.
Cushing film?
Please, can we do that? Yeah, although you will have
Sorry, I
to.
said Invasion of Earth. That was a little grammatically correct. Invasion Earth 2150 AD.
Daleks Invasion Earth. Yeah, they didn't have to even
Yeah, you
have
don't have
Doctor
to
Who in the
use,
title.
no.
Good grief. Oh, the incidental music in that as well.
I do love that. Yeah.
You've got to think about jazz in Doctor Who, haven't you?
I kind of have. Yeah.
Well, we'll reconvene on post-apocalyptic Earth in the year 2150 AD very soon. But this just leaves me to say thank you very much for your time tonight. It is always a delight to talk to you.
Thank you. Likewise. Here's to the future.